Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Desiree Mays. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, the book now in its 11th year that describes the five operas of the Santa Fe opera season. Desiree lectures nightly at the Preview Buffet of the Santa Fe Opera. She's an international opera lecturer and spends much of the winter season lecturing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And she's tour director of Act One Tours, which takes people all over the world to see opera. The Santa Fe Opera season this year opens on Friday, July 3rd. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Today is the third Monday in our series on the Santa Fe Opera, and we're here to talk about the opera Alceste by Christoph Willibald Gluck. I love saying the German. And this is a Baroque opera. I thought before we get into even what a Baroque opera is, it would be interesting to talk about, as you do in your book, Opera Unveiled, about the origins of opera. It didn't just evolve naturally, like an amphibian climbing out of the water. It was really some people got together and said, let's make a new art form.
Yes and no. This was a group of noblemen who gathered together in Florence in around 1600, and they were called the Camerata because they met in a room. And the word, of course, is camera is room. What they wanted to do was to take to restore the purity of Greek theater. They were very into Greek theater and drama at the time, and attach music to it. But the music would always be very secondary. So they'd have the Greek drama in a sung form with very simple accompaniment, where the words were much more important than the music. And of course, one of the great issues in opera is that roller coaster ride, and the question, are the words more important or the music? Is the play, the drama more important than the music? And sometimes the music is more important, other times the words. But in the beginning, it was about very simple sung lines with very simple accompaniment and a very natural word setting. And this was done, of course, in the private palaces of these noblemen. It was certainly not open to the public, per se, and that didn't happen for some time. So it was a sort of something they did amongst themselves. They had a lot of time on their hands, and they had a lot of money. And as time went on, this whole thing that came to be called opera caught on. And it sort of got blown out of all proportion. They spent a lot of money on this, and there was a lot of one-upmanship of who could present the most spectacular opera. So they would take Roman or Greek myths, and then they would fully stage them. I mean, they would take a palace room or a garden and transform it into these extraordinary sets. So on one hand, they had magnificent sets and scenery and costumes. I mean, money was no object. And then on the other, they had this amazing singer, the castrato singer. These were young boys who were castrated at an early age to maintain that beautiful, high, pure sound.
Well, so an early age meaning shortly before adolescence.
Before their voice broke. Yeah. The idea was to maintain the beauty of that high sound. But of course, because this, whatever this does to one's hormones, they grew to be sort of ungainly. They grew to be very big, some of these people. Their bone structure grew. There was sort of no control over that. With the result was they had amazing rib cages often, and breath capacity. So they could sing on one note forever, and apparently it was an extraordinarily beautiful sound, and people were swooning in the aisles, and these castrati came to be superstars. You know, Michael Jackson, on about that sort of level in terms of following, and the whole thing was sort of over the top. So this was happening, and then there were the sopranos who matched them, and there were stories of wars between the castrati and the soprano of upstaging one another on stage. And this whole simpleness that had started the whole movement got perverted. Once the singer got center stage, they would embellish and ornament their roles at will. One composer, I forget who it was, went to an opera of his, and he said he didn't recognize the aria as his because of the way it had been ornamented. So they would carry on, and the audience loved this. But it was really running opera into a dead end. It was getting out of hand, and it was literally over the top.
So this is like 150 years after this Camerata thing.
Yeah, the Camerata was the 1600s, and they were very simple. Daphne was a typical, so Orpheus and Eurydice. These were the sort of pieces that they chose. And then along came Christoph Willibald Gluck. Gluck wanted to bring opera back to its simplicity, and he wrote what are called three reform operas that sort of put opera back on track again, because it probably would have run itself into the ground and ended.
So reform operas, it sounds so Protestant.
it was a simplicity that he was after.
Like Protestantism.
Perhaps. He wrote an introduction to Alceste, which is as famous as the opera itself, in which he outlined what he did and did not want to do with the opera. He didn't want to change it. He wanted to sort of clean it up. He said an overture, for instance, should have some resemblance to what's going on in the music, which makes sense. So after that, overtures began to include the themes that you would hear in the later work. He decided to stop the grandstanding of the singers so that the music would not be written, so that they could carry on these long cadenzas and their own pieces indefinitely. And in fact, some of the singers would insist that music be written so that they could catch their breath before going on to the next. It was all about the accommodation of the singers. And the way he controlled this was that he would very often conduct from the pit, and then he really could control the singers. So what happened was he met a man called Ranieri Calzabigi, who was a man of like mind, much impressed with the French Enlightenment, as these people were, this was beginning to happen historically at the time. And they wrote three operas that changed the course of opera. With some of these reforms, and you'll hear that simplicity. So while they're still using Greek sources, Greek stories, as Alceste is, moved back from the extreme ornamentation. And of course, out of this, out of the Gluck operas, came classicism and Mozart, not very long after. So to put them in a sort of the historical context, Gluck comes in the middle of the early Baroque and the classicism of Mozart. An interesting thing happened too with this opera. It first premiered in Vienna in 1767, and then Gluck met a Frenchman who really was in tune with him, and they decided to rework the opera along these lines and present it in Paris, which they did in 1777, 11 years later. And actually, it's the French version that is most typically performed today, and that's the one that the Santa Fe Opera will be presenting. So in telling the story here, there's sort of three stories. One is the original Greek story, then there's the Italian version, and then the French version. But we'll probably just confine ourselves to the to the French one, because that's the one that we'll be presenting. So it's interesting. I mean, opera changes all the time. It's a living, vibrant art form. As with anything, it becomes stagnant and dies if there's not change. And as we'll see with the letter, and when we talk about contemporary opera, change has been dramatic in the last 100 years. Opera opened up to the public around about the time of Gluck. Now there were public theaters, so people could go to the opera, and the people began to be part of the interaction. You still had the aristocracy who owned their boxes. And when they went to the opera, they didn't pay much attention to anything except the arias. They would go for their favorite castrato singer singing a specific aria. And the rest they'd ignore. They'd party, they'd play games, they'd eat dinner behind the boxes. And if you go to La Scala in Milan, there's the box that you see in those wonderful pictures, and there's a corridor behind it. And behind that, there's a little room where their servers would prepare meals and drinks. And all sorts of assignations went on. They could draw the curtains, right, and God knows what happened up there. But they didn't pay any attention to the music. Part of this, too, was because in those days there was no lighting. So the lights never went down. The whole thing was constantly lit from beginning to end. As soon as electric lighting came into being and you could darken the house, it sort of silenced the crowd and they'd pay attention to what was going on stage. So there's been many, evolution has happened in many ways in terms of opera, but Gluck comes at the first change since the beginning, and his work is quite lovely. For people who saw Platé a few years ago, the opera about the frog, you'll hear the similar style in the music, but But this is lovely. This opera is a sort of a lament. Shall we get into it a little?
Tell the story.
Yeah, well, Alceste is, she and her husband, Admet is the husband, are the king and queen in this Greek town. And the husband has sickened and is dying. And the people are mourning that he is dying, and Alceste is tearing her hair out. And she comes to the temple of Apollo, and with the high priest they pray to Apollo that the king may be saved. And then out of the statue of Apollo comes the voice of the oracle that says that Admet may live if another offers his life in his place. And there's a nice little anecdote here. Apparently, when the young Mozart went to see the opera we have just talked about, went to see
Don Giovanni,
the voice of the Commendatore found its source in the oracle in Alceste, in Gluck's opera. This child was so impressed. He said, "Oh, that's so cool, the voice coming out of the statue. I'm going to put that in my opera." And years later, it became the voice of the Commendatore. Anyway, the voice says that another must die in place of the king if the king is to live. So this doesn't seem to be a problem. Surely anybody would give their life for their beloved king. But when it turns out, people don't want to die for the king.
But even the king's elderly parents wouldn't. Neither of them would
give their
life for the king.
That's right.
Amazing.
I think most people put on the spot will choose life over death.
But even if it's the death of their child?
This is not a child.
Son.
Yes, exactly. So, no, in this case, no, they all decide. So everybody scatters. They don't like the pronouncement. They make themselves scarce, except for Alceste, who says, "I cannot live without him. I will offer my life in his place." So the next scene then is where the king is recovering and everyone's rejoicing. And there's a marvelous juxtaposition here of the rejoicing of the people and the king. And Alceste comes in really sad. She has talked to the underworld and the high priest has told her that they have accepted her sacrifice and she will go to Hades. And she comes in. Well, let's play a bit of that music first. Maybe the first section I have for you is the grand priest who has felt the earth move beneath his feet. And he's heard from the oracle that Alceste's offer of giving her life in place of her husband has been accepted. And this leads into a really stunning aria. You'll hear the trombones play a little theme that's unforgettable as she talks to the pale shades of death and about her sacrifice. And on this recording, you'll hear Anne-Sophie von Otter sing Alceste, and the grand priest is Dietrich Henschel, a bass.
Thank you.
and that is Alceste, sung in this recording by Anne-Sophie von Otter from Gluck's opera. And we will have the great Christine Brewer sing our Alceste here in Santa Fe.
And that's a beautiful story.
Of Christine?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. She has made a major career for herself. She's one of the most sought-after now singers. And this opera is one that great singers choose very often as their last performance, actually. It's a sort of a star vehicle piece, so you need a really outstanding Alceste if the opera is going to work. A lot of it is a lament, and how beautifully that is sung is really important. Christine Brewer tells a wonderful story of how when she was a young singer, she applied for she sang at a competition that Richard Gaddis, our previous general director, was adjudicating. And after he heard, she didn't win, but after he heard her performance, he sent her a letter and said that he thought one day she was going to be a dramatic soprano and just needed to be patient and keep working. And a couple of days after this note arrived, she received a check from him in the amount she would have won if she'd won the competition. Is that wonderful? I mean, what a gift.
I mean, what a gift. And it's an inspiring reason to keep going, and she did, and
absolutely.
Here she is.
And I think shows the greatness of heart of Richard Gaddis.
Indeed.
He was so great to young singers. And he also offered her a job singing in the chorus with the Opera Theatre of St. Louis. So she went on from strength to strength. She sang Tristan and Isolde in London and received rave reviews for that. And then I remember this performance, one I'll never forget, in 2002 here when John Crosby died, and they had a memorial service for him in the theater, and Christine Brewer sang Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs. I mean, that was an amazing performance. There wasn't a dry eye in the
right.
house. So I think she's going to be very warmly welcomed back here to sing Alceste. She's a very special, very wonderful singer.
So let's go back to Alceste. It's interesting. I mean, for those who listen every week, we did Don Giovanni last week. This week, Alceste, which opened exactly 20 years before Don Giovanni, it seems like that's a long 20 years in terms of the development of opera.
Yes, a lot happened at that.
1767 to 1787.
That's right. And it's surprising that they are that close. I hadn't realized, actually, put the two dates together. But yes, a lot happened in that time. First of all, we now see the end of the castrati. They are now finished. And in their place, we see the emergence of the tenor. Either the tenor or they use sopranos in castrati roles. So it's another reason, bone of contention, a soprano would get these roles. But these were called pants roles. So Orpheus and Eurydice, for instance, could be sung by two women. By Orpheus and Eurydice would be two women, different voices. But that was very common, as we saw the end of the castrati disappear out of the history. The style evolved into the classical style, of which Mozart, of course, is the greatest exponent. And, you know, Mozart didn't do anything really innovative or new. He took the style as it was, and he developed it. He looked into the characterizations. Instead of having sort of cardboard characters who would sing a lament at the death of a husband, he would make them real people with real motivations and real feelings. That part was one of the great strengths of Mozart. And Gluck is moving in this direction in this opera. She's not a cardboard character. This is a woman, and this happened a lot, actually, in the 10-year period from the Vienna premiere to the French premiere, where she becomes more, she's not just a woman grieving the potential loss of a husband and sacrificing her life, nor he. Their interaction, husband and wife, king and queen, is very precious, is very special, and it's very beautifully rounded out in the music. But it is there is this dynamic between the two of them, and this scene where Admet, the king, is beginning to recover, and he wants to rejoice, and then he asks of his priest who has given his, when he hears, who has given his life, and they say, we don't know, and he's angry. He said, the gods are not right. I would prefer to die that one of my subjects give up their life for me. Then Alceste comes in, but she's not rejoicing. She's not happy.
Wait, he's changed his mind?
No, he says when he hears of the bargain, when he hears the deal with the gods have said someone must die in his place. No, he says, this is not right. I should be the one to die, but it's a done deal by this point. You can't really renegotiate, apparently, with the gods. And he doesn't at this point know about Alceste. So she comes in, and he is concerned. They have this long dialogue together where, and the aria I'll play you next, he says, banish your fear. Everything's fine. I'm recovering. It's going to be fine. And in the course of this long section, she comes to tell him that she is the one who is making the sacrifice. And he absolutely rages. He says, no, I insist that I will die. You are not going to your death. And this goes on for quite a while. But
because it's opera.
Because it's opera. And it's the Baroque style, which, you know, it goes on. Now, another thing that happened musically at this time, with the earlier form, we had the da capo aria, where you would have the first theme, a second theme, and then they go back to the first da capo, the head, go back to the first aria. And when they go back, they would embellish it and ornament it. And that would be endless. I mean, you would have three lines of libretto that could last for 10 minutes.
Right.
This is no longer really happening now. Gluck is moving forward out of this. So it's more of a sort of a sung through approach to the arias. So in this particular aria, the tenor, the king, Admet, says to Alceste, banish your fear. Things are going to be all right. And actually, the tenor on this recording, it's interesting, it's Paul Groves. He is going to be the tenor who will sing here in Santa Fe this summer.
Uh-huh.
So I think this is the sound of the tenor you'll hear. So let's hear a little of his aria.
Oh, veux me quitter sans retour, et tu veux que je vive, et tu dis que tu m'aimes. Qui parmi toi veut disposer de toi? Les serments de l'amour et ceux de l'imanine ne te tiennent-tu pas à mes lois enchaînées? Tes jours, tous tes moments ne sont-ils pas à moi? Veux-tu me les nourrir sans être criminelle? Veux-tu pouvoir mourir cruelle sans payer tes semences de l'époux et de moi? Il est Dieu souffrir cet affreux sacrifice.
Ils sont été sensibles à mes pleurs.
Un amour insensible, un roi par un caprice, approuverait-il être fidèle? Non, j'ai courbé comme est la suprême justice. Ils tourneront sur moi le coup. Ils m'attendront la première victime.
You can hear there the anger of the husband who is not about to let his wife go to the underworld and die.
Yeah, so he's starting to recover and get over his illness
and she's
at
made
the
this,
cost of her life.
At the cost of her life, yes. So in the middle of all this, then Hercules comes to call. He's taking a rest from his labors by visiting his friends. It makes it so... I love that. It's beautiful. It's
it
a very human moment. So he arrives at the house thinking he's going to have a weekend off of partying and finds out he's walked into the middle of this drama. The king is recovering, but Alcestis on her way to the underworld. So he says, I'm Hercules. I'll fix it. I will go. I will fight the infernal deities and I will bring Alcestis back from Hades and reunite the two of you, which is exactly what he does. It's a wonderful sort of high point of the whole opera. So he brings her back.
I mean, you have to be Hercules to do that,
to do
because
that,
you make
right.
a deal with the gods. You can't just undo that.
That's right. So so Apollo then gets in the act. Apollo descends from the heavens and he restores order as always was expected of Greek drama. And of course that happened too in Don Giovanni. Remember at the end they restore
right.
order and the status quo. Apollo does it here. He applauds the couple, the happy couple who are reunited, and he congratulates Hercules for his courage in fighting the infernal deities to bring her back. So I thought it might be fun to play. You'll hear, I mean, the switch in this is amazing. From all this, the sadness, the lament, the deep sadness in this music that Gluck, in a very simple way, manages to express the pain that both are feeling. Especially Alcestis, who is determined to die, but she's leaving the husband and children she loves. And then the switch to Hercules, which turns this Greek drama, would be Greek drama, into something else at the end with a happy ending, which was sort of unexpected. So let's hear Hercules, and this is sung by Dietrich Henschel.
Au pouvoir de la mort, je saurai la ravir. Reposez-vous sur un ami sensible. Reposez-vous sur ce bras invincible. Au pouvoir de la mort, je saurai la ravir. Cet affreux enfer, comte-ce sa victime, comte-ce sa victime. Non, vous ne perdrez pas l'objet de votre amour. Non, vous ne perdrez pas l'objet de votre amour. Je descendrai. J'en jure par le Dieu qui me donna le jour. Vous ne perdrez pas l'objet de votre amour, l'objet de votre amour. Cet affreux enfer, comte-ce sa victime, comte-ce sa victime. Je descendrai plutôt au ténébreux abîme. J'en jure par le Dieu qui me donna le jour. Vous ne
Was Hercules promising that he will bring Alceste back from the underworld near the end of Alceste, the opera by Gluck, which the Santa Fe Opera will be presenting this summer.
And so nobody has to pay the price that the underworld didn't get their live flesh.
No, we don't go there. There are all sorts of loose ends in opera. It
right.
doesn't hang together always, and you have to suspend belief.
Well,
in
and also,
reality.
I mean, Hercules basically fought and won, and he was.
It was a fair fight. He went. He was in the midst of his labors, and after his labors and these good acts, where he brought the true wife back to her husband, he's applauded by Apollo and awarded godlike status at the end of it all. But he's used for dramatic purposes in this, to turn the mood around, to change it, and it's not really. In fact, in each version at the end of this opera, it's always different. In other versions, Apollo saves Alceste.
Oh, interesting.
And in another one, Persephone, the queen of the underworld, sees the plight and learns of Alceste's sacrifice and forgives her and sends her back to the real world. So there are ways out of the underworld. It also raises the question, what and where is the underworld? Is
right.
it hell, Hades? You know, it's another whole.
Yeah, I mean, two out of three of our operas so far have featured the underworld.
Yeah, yes, I hadn't
another.
Thought of that. That's right. We have.
So Alceste opens on the 1st of August at the Santa Fe Opera. I guess it's not playing in July. And it features dancers. And I love to talk about this with you because you were a ballet dancer who danced
right.
for operas.
That's right. Yes. I was reared on opera as a child. I was very fortunate. My parents brought me to the opera and the symphony and the ballet as a young child. And my mother had wanted to be a dancer and it hadn't worked out. She got married and had me. So I was going to be the dancer. And actually, that was fine with me. So I was sent from Ireland to England to a school where I studied full-time dance and then became a student in London. And one of my first jobs when I graduated was I never went to college. In Europe, you don't go to college to learn how to be a dancer. You go to schools that specifically focus on theater and dance.
Yeah,
conservatory. So with Sadler's Wells Opera Ballet, which was wonderful, and I learned about being a dancer in the ballet, which is tough because if an opera is running too long, the first thing that gets cut is the ballet. And the other thing is that stage sets are pretty heavy duty for opera. You know, they're big sets and there's pieces of furniture around. Now, for a ballet, you need a fairly clear stage, and there's always that sort of dilemma where we're not moving this piece of scenery for this dance, so you've got to work around it. So, the chorus is on here. It's very tricky. Today, with the young singers, they are taught to, they are dancers. I mean, they can act, they can sing, they can dance. So, very often, they will have the young singers, actually do the dances. Now, it depends. In this year, for instance, the dance that's going to happen in the Santa Fe Opera is in Alceste. Gluck wrote some of the most beautiful ballet music, and I'm so happy they're not being cut in this production. The first is near the beginning, where the Alceste and the people go to the Temple of Apollo to ask for the king's recovery, and the dancers are the Vestal Virgin, so to speak, who dance in the temple. That's a beautiful. It's a very beautiful piece of music, we're having Anna Ypres, who focuses on Baroque dance from Paris, will come in as the choreographer, and then later, of course, at the end, she will be the spirits of the infernal deities, the hellish beings who take Alceste to hell, will be danced. There's a wonderful set in this production. It's not a Greek palace, the traditional Greek setting. It's a big set of sort of very organic, of great sort of stones that light beautifully. It's a sort of a wall of these stones that light, and when the time comes for Alceste to go to the underworld, that whole set closes in on itself, and there are windows of red fire through which the dancers come. It's very effective. I'm dying to see this. I've just heard about it. I haven't seen it yet. So that's a different approach. But yes, there is dance in this. And of course, we've had some wonderful dance in the Laurent Pellis operas recently, the Cenerentola and a couple of others. So Santa Fe does use dance, and the French love dance. I mean, for the French in the early days of opera, they were far more interested in the ballet than the opera. So there's been a sort of shift, again, like the words of music are opera, dance or no dance. It is opera, and there is some dance, and thank goodness there is in Alsace. So, yeah, it was great being part of that. I mean, I loved that. I mean, one of my first jobs was a sort of as a dancing extra at Covent Garden, the only time I put foot on that stage professionally. And it was Aida, and they had the proverbial elephant crossing the stage. We were given a bit of sackcloth and told to act as the slaves following the elephant, which is what we did. We were all of the grand march, and Aida just crossed the stage. I'm given £5 for it, and that was wonderful. I mean, just to be there was great.
Amazing, amazing.
It was fun.
I thought this would also be a good time, because we have a little bit of time after the happy ending of the opera Alceste, to talk about, I mean, the conductor conducts the music, the director directs the action on stage. Who is it? It has to be the director who comes up with the whole concept for the opera, whether it's going to be set in 1950s costumes or whether...
Right, that's true. And again, this is something that's been sort of a roller coaster. There was the age of the conductor, where the conductor was all important. You would talk about, the specific conductor's interpretation of a piece. And then it became, and probably is still today, the day of the director. You're going back to Franco Zeffirelli. You talk about a Franco Zeffirelli production. And then I think over the last 50 years, there's been this trend to look at these operas and not present them in their traditional formats as written by the librettist and the composer, but to, I hate to use the word update, but to interpret them in a new way. And this has had some success, and in some of it, it's been a total disaster because it seems to be done just for shock effect. This happens a lot in Germany. I mean, to the extent that I just read last week that in some production of a Strauss opera, the singers walked out en masse. They refused to do what was asked of them.
Really?
I mean, there's nudity, there's sex on stage, there's unbelievable things which were never intended and really seemed to have very little connect to the piece as it was originally written.
So like some kind of hyper realistic interpretation.
Absolutely. And audiences don't like it, and the singers clearly don't like it. I talked to the man who sang Wotan in The Ring recently, just a couple of weeks ago back in New York, and he says he is now turning down roles where this is a very extreme interpretation.
So, interesting.
Now, here in Santa Fe, I think what has happened has been very interesting. There are times when the opera is in a new setting, like L'Elysée d'Amour. The Elixir of Love is updated somewhat. But that works. The story is timeless. It's still an Italian olive factory, not the
olive oil trees. Factory, right.
You know, it's fine. And it works. The story of this little story of love is timeless. I think with this one, we're not set in the traditional Greek temple, but I don't think it has to be. It's fairly close. And we've never done extreme versions. I'll never forget, it was Jonathan Miller, the great director, who said once that this can work, changing the time frame, if it's done with integrity. I've always thought of that. I mean, I think it's very important. Francesco Zambello, too, she believes we need to be doing, and we can look at new interpretations, but there has to be a reason for it and a connect to the original. It has to work. I mean, if you have animals coming out of hotel rooms, which has happened, I mean, which is in the original but does not work in the new concept. So that's something the general director decides with a director. When they hire a director, they know their work. And this is a question for Charles McKay, perhaps, when you talk with him, that how do they agree how the concept of the opera will be presented? And concepts are now a tricky word, too, because it can have a negative connotation, but it needs have if it's done with integrity. And I think here at Santa Fe, the company is to be applauded. They've done a very good job of that, of changing the original idea and making something really worthwhile to present to the audiences. So should we play a little more music?
Yes.
Let's play a little bit from the point at which Alceste approaches Hades. She's now very frightened, but she's determined that she's not going to change her mind. But as she's about to, and the stage directions are very gothic. You know, on one side there's an altar with a scythe over it, and there's hellfire billowing out of a cave in a rock, and she's headed in this direction, and they're calling her, "Unhappy Alceste, where are you going? Malheureuse Alceste." You'll hear that. And then her husband appears and he tries to save her and says, "I'm going in your place." And the spirits are insisting she make up her mind. And so it's a great scene at that point. And this is just before Hercules shows up and goes to save her. So let's hear a little of this. And this, again, the Alceste on this recording is Anne-Sophie von Otter.
Is just about the end of our show. We've been talking about the opera Alceste, which is part of the Santa Fe opera season this year. We're going 5 Mondays. This is the 3rd Monday. We're right in the middle. The opera season opens very soon. And if you want to find out more, Desiree's book, Opera Unveiled,
The book's out there all over. It's at the opera shop. And the book gives background to the operas. It tells the stories and raises some of the issues that we've been talking about. So hopefully it's helpful. It's when you get to the opera, it's really good to know the story ahead of time because some of these relationships are a little odd. I mean, who is Hercules when he shows up in the middle of this?
Exactly.
So that helps. And it's at the leading bookstores in Santa Fe, the opera shop, of course, and in Albuquerque. So if that helps, great.
Desiree, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled and the nightly lecturer at the Preview Buffet at the Santa Fe Opera. The Santa Fe Opera season this year opens on Friday, July 3rd. They can be found on the web at santafeopera.org, and the box office number is 800-280-4654. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz. Thank you.